supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, 70% of Americans have a favorable opinion of the new commander-in-chief, but almost half of the electorate voted for Senator McCain. So how was the election ultimately decided? Did we use our heads or our hearts? And when passion is involved, and there was passion in this election, healing is difficult. So how does the country unite after the election? Later on in the show, we'll be talking with Phil Goldsmith. He's a political consultant and a past city managing director. We'll talk with Phil about what it might be like going from Barack to Mr. President-elect. But right now, I am joined on the telephone by Dr. Drew Weston. He's a professor of psychology and psychiatry at Emory. He's the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. Drew, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
And I'm also joined by Sheila Heen. She's been on before. She's the co-author of Difficult Conversations, and she teaches negotiation at Harvard Law School. Sheila, hi. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you.
Sheila, let's start with you. You are in a Democrat-Republican marriage, so do you have metal detectors at the front door?
That's a great question. What we did have up front, in front of the house, were his and hers political signs, you know, marked as such. I was on the Democratic side with my Obama sign, and my husband has been a longtime McCain supporter. And one of the things that's really interesting to me is that, you know, I've found the aftermath of the election to actually be much harder than all of the months leading up to the election.
You?
Yeah, I have. Well, I think one thing I didn't anticipate, even on Election Day, was that the intellectual disagreements that we had that leading up to Election Day didn't prepare me for how differently we would feel in the wake of the election. And that gulf between my relief and excitement and pride and my husband's disappointment and frustration has actually been much harder to navigate in the last 6 days than, you know, the previous 6 months.
Tell us, if you don't mind, what that gulf looks like, feels like to you, to him?
Well, it's interesting because I think that one of the things that has happened is that in the wake of the election, those of us who are absolutely delighted, unconflicted, joyful, et cetera, have had the floor nationally. And internationally, of course, the international community is expressing many of the same feelings. And so I think that when you're on the winning side, it's very easy for it to feel like, well, justice was done. Of course, this was the right result. But I think that our delight and joy is really easy to hear as turning to maybe glee, which has a little bit of a harder edge to it, to right. Those who are more conflicted. And one of the things that I think is happening is that we're simplifying it as if it's just two sides, when in fact there's a hugely complicated set of emotions around this election. There are people who were Hillary supporters who are reluctant Barack supporters. And I've talked to some who feel like, well, all this hoopla about the first black president, it is wonderful, but come on, we could have had the first woman president. So they're a little annoyed at the emphasis in some cases. You know, and on the other side, there are people who, you know, loved McCain, didn't like Palin, loved Palin, disliked McCain. People who were McCain supporters, who switched to be Obama supporters, but who disagree with a lot of things. So I think that there actually is a host of complicated emotions that are sort of beneath the surface nationally.
So let me turn to you, Drew, and could you give us kind of a brief psychological postmortem?
Oh, sure. One of the things that was really different about this election from past elections is that the Democrats took a very different strategy towards winning it than they've taken since Bill Clinton and before him, since LBJ and JFK, and that is that Democrats traditionally believe that elections are debates on the issues, where it comes down to, you know, who's got this health care plan versus that health care plan. That stuff all certainly, it certainly matters. But when you look at how voters vote, what you really see is that people vote on the basis of primarily two things. One is how they're feeling right now and in general towards the parties and their basic principles or values. And the second is their gut level feelings about the two candidates. Are they comfortable with them? Are they inspired by them? Do they make them anxious? And, you know, in many ways you can see this election, those two factors alone, people's gut level feelings towards the parties and their principles, and their gut level feelings towards the candidates and what the candidates inspire in them in terms of emotionally, those predict just about all there is to be predicted in presidential elections. That if you hold constant, statistically, those kind of feelings and feelings towards the character of the people who are running, and you look at what's the predictive value of, quote-unquote, the issues and their stands and policy positions and 12-point plans, the 12-point plans don't predict anything in terms of who wins. And it's not to say that it doesn't get entered into their emotional calculations. Those things, sure, you know, if someone felt that they heard some of the details of McCain's economic plan realistically, what in many respects what happened was you saw in the middle of September, you saw McCain respond to the financial meltdown in a way that seemed really erratic and unsteady, and you saw Obama respond in a way that was just really, really steady. And I don't think most people knew the differences in their plans, but they sure did notice the differences in their demeanor, and that had a huge impact on voters.
Let me reintroduce you. We're talking with Drew Weston. He's the author of The Political Brain, and we're in the process of doing a psychological postmortem. We're also speaking with Sheila Heen, who's the author of Difficult Conversations, and we're going to talk about healing the country as we move along. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Drew, when you talked about the issues that win elections, you used the word gut two or three times. So I'm thinking in terms of gastric juices and wondering if we shouldn't be using another part of our anatomy to intervene, something about the frontal lobe, cerebral cortex.
It's a very good point. Yeah. And in fact, when I say gut level feelings, it's actually not so much feelings that are coming from either gastric juices or in some cases indigestion. We're actually talking about a couple of different. What we now know about the brain is that both thinking and feeling they're intertwined naturally, and their circuits intertwine. But that there's a strip of cortex that's towards the front of the brain. It's called, the technical term for people interested, it's dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is a fancy way of saying it's a strip of the brain towards the front along the top and sides that's involved in our conscious reasoning processes. And then there are a number of circuits that are involved, starting in right between the eyeballs and the frontal lobes and moving backwards, that are involved in emotional responses. And it's those emotional responses that have a much bigger effect on people's voting behavior than that thin strip of cortex that we like to think of as reason and as our reasoning.
But let me ask you this. We know that politics are about emotion, but it seemed that McCain was peddling more emotion. It was about fear, and Obama was talking about hope. And certainly fear is the deeper emotion and the more passionate emotion. So why did Obama win?
I think it's really two things. One is that Obama not only talked about hope, but he inspired it in a way that we really haven't seen since. I think the last president who did it was before him was Bill Clinton. The last one who did it before him was probably Ronald Reagan. You know, in terms of, for very different people, but in terms of instilling that sense of hope in America and hope in change, and you know, both Reagan and Clinton ran in very difficult economic times on a platform of change, and you know, Clinton, even his motto was, "Do you want change or more of the same?" But I think in many respects, what we saw was with Obama versus McCain was not only hope in Obama, but also anxiety about the economy, which by mid to late fall had really started to affect everyone in the country, including a lot of moderate Republicans, particularly middle class and upper middle class moderate Republicans, who never would have dreamed of voting for Obama, and who, it turns out, when you look at the final exit polls, you know, carry only won 35% of people making over $200,000 a year. Obama won 52% of them, and a lot of those people were carried over to the Obama side by, you know, they looked at their 401ks and their 529s for their kids' college education, and it scared the hell out of them because they had just lost, like all of us have just lost. I mean, I don't know about you, but I stopped reading mine after reading the first one. They now just go straight into the recycling bin. Right. We had all just lost a third of our assets, and it made people really anxious. And I think in some ways it came down to anxiety about the economy versus anxiety about Obama's race.
That's interesting.
And I think anxiety about the economy won out.
That's interesting. So, Sheila, let's turn to you. You know, we're talking about this passion and anxiety, and we know that the more anxiety goes up, the more tightly we clutch onto our beliefs, and the more tightly we clutch onto our beliefs, the more hurt or alienated or betrayed we feel when we don't get what we want, which is partly, I think, what's happening after the election. I read where gun sales have skyrocketed.
Sales are skyrocketing, which is a fascinating phenomenon, and at least on the surface, the logic is, well, because people are worried that gun laws will change, so they want to get grandfathered. I don't know if it has to do with people's reaction to the election, but I suspect that part of what's going on is that because the winners, quote-unquote, the people who are excited and proud and, you know, like the Grinch, our hearts swelled three times the size that day, that night, we have the floor. So you've got a silent, huge portion of the country who feels conflicted, but who isn't talking about it yet. And one of the most fascinating aspects of that right now is that those people are the people in our families and in our neighborhoods. That, you know, there are people who are voting in different directions in extended families all over the country, and that actually presents the opportunity for healing to happen at the individual level in the near term, in these weeks and months as we're going home and having Thanksgiving dinner together.
So let me ask about your home and your marriage. How are you and your husband, I guess your discord now, how is your husband going to heal? I guess smug on the winner's part isn't going to cut it.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the dangers, which is being gracious on each side really comes at a premium at the moment. Now, listen, I come from a divided family on both sides. You know, I grew up in Nebraska, which is one of the reddest states in the country, and, you know, my parents can't believe how I've gone down the tubes. On my husband's side, in August at family vacation, at dinner, we went around the table and said, who are you voting for and why? And we had three McCain supporters, three Obama supporters, and three undecideds. And so one of the things that we've been trying to teach our kids is that in a democracy, it's okay to have different opinions about who you think the best choice might be. And that as citizens, your responsibility is to really think hard about the issues, ask as many questions as you can, talk to other people about it, and not just people who agree with you. And that our responsibility in teaching kids how to handle conflict in their lives, this is a real opportunity for us to demonstrate that.
Well, and we're going to talk about many of the hows and whys. Let's see if we can get a phone call in before our break. We've got Amelia on the line. Amelia, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to comment about how I was a huge supporter of Barack Obama, and I was so excited on Tuesday and Wednesday when he won the election, but I was really disheartened by hearing from some people around me, including a friend, a neighbor of mine, who I had known was a Republican, but he made a comment that really upset me. He came out and asked, he said, "And what do you think they're going to do to the White House?" And it really hurt me to see that this person who I considered a friend had some really, I felt like it was a really racist comment to make.
So I guess I will turn to you, Drew, first of all, and ask that, you know, is the potential for this bubbling racism to get worse in the wake of the election? I mean, the hope is, you know, the naive hope is that it's going to go away now.
Yeah, my guess is that it's going to be a lot like the economy. It's going to get worse, and then it's going to get better. I do think there's going to be that the Amelia's comments are disheartening, and I live in the South where you hear some of those sentiments as well. But it's not just in the South. I mean, I heard from my barber before the election, you know, who whispered in my ear something about he's just going to favor black people when he gets into office. So those sentiments are clearly out there. There's a lesson, though, to be learned from the what happened in the aftermath of the 65 Civil Rights Act, which was that when Martin Luther King was asked about the question in the mid-60s about quote-unquote the mixing of the races, which was illegal in most states at that time, his response was to say, you know, "I want the white man to be my brother and not my brother-in-law." And there was a real wisdom in that, because what he was saying is, let's deal with voting first. People will realize that it's not the end of Western democracy and American democracy as we know it to let black people vote. And the issue about interracial marriage is people are going to get more comfortable as they see it over time. And it turned out, it took 10 years later, the Supreme Court overturned the laws against it, and it turned out that no disasters happened. And, you know, probably one of the most robust findings in the research literature on psychotherapy is that exposure to things that you're afraid of is one of the best cures of them. And in this case, my guess is that when give it a year, and when people have realized that having a black president turns out to be no different than having a white president, and that the White House is not going to be painted black, and that he's not going to be giving special favors to black people, and then he's going to be president of the United States like other presidents of the United States, I think that the effect of that is actually going to be very, very powerful in changing racial attitudes.
That's a wonderful perspective. Amelia, thanks so much for your call. We're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk more about what we need to do to heal and what specifically our responsibility is as, you know, those who voted for Obama. What's our responsibility now to those who didn't? We're talking about healing after the election. My guests are Sheila Heen. She teaches negotiation at Harvard Law School. She's the co-author of Difficult Conversations, and she works with labor management and locked-in conflict, family, businesses, communities divided by racial strife. I'm also joined by Drew Weston. He's a professor of psychology and psychiatry at Emory. He's written The Political Brain. He's also a political commentator and strategist. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Well, we'll be back after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family, right here on WHYY-FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
It's your turn. If you're over 50 and have embraced a new passion or direction in life, we want to hear your story. Stories of encore careers, new experiences, and creative civic involvement. Be a part of our compelling coming-of-age radio series. Share your story by going to whyy.org/wider horizons. That's whyy.org/wider horizons.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about healing after the election. What happened and what is our responsibility to help contribute to healing? Later on, we're going to talk about what it's like for Barack Obama going from Barack or Senator Obama to Mr. President-elect. But right now, we're talking with Drew Weston. He's a professor of psychology at Emory. He's author of The Political Brain, and Sheila Heen, who teaches negotiation at Harvard Law School, and she's co-authored Difficult Conversations. Sheila, I want to turn to you with the question I opened up right before our break, and that is, what is our responsibility? What is the winner's responsibility to help healing the country?
Well, I think that one of the things that we have to remember is that voting for John McCain and supporting the McCain-Palin ticket was an absolutely legitimate, rational, and emotional choice. And it's really easy to accuse people, well, you didn't vote for him because you must be racist, or you didn't vote for him because, you know, you're stuck in your own view of the world and you can't see it more expansively, or you don't understand the international community's perspective on us. It's just too easy to point fingers and blame, and I think that stance is going to get us in real trouble, particularly in the wake of the election when people aren't holding out hope that their side will prevail. And so I think one of the things that we can do is to focus on common ground, and the common ground is really what we're all worried about. In other words, we all have concerns about what's going to happen in the coming months with the war, with the economy, et cetera, and conversations over Thanksgiving dinner about, you know, what was your reaction to the election? What are you worried about? I'm worried, too.
Yeah, that's interesting that when we spoke with you earlier, that was the question you asked. What are you worried about? And that really opens up a dialogue, as long as the answer is not hostile towards the other person.
Yes, and I'll forewarn everybody that you will hear hostile answers from each side.
Right. And then what? Where do you go with that?
Well, I think at that point the critical thing is not to either defend yourself or attack back, which is all of our reactive instincts. But instead to ask one more follow-up question, or, you know, you sound really angry about this. Where does that come from? Tell me about it. Often what they're reacting internally to something they've read on a blog or a conversation they've had with someone else. They're not really reacting to you.
Well, and the other thing I hear through the lens of, through the ears of a clinician is when I hear that kind of reactivity, they're not really answering the question, because what I'm hearing is they're telling us what they are angry at, and I want to know what they're worried about.
Yeah, and I think often, and you probably see this all the time too, anger is actually a secondary emotion that has fear or anxiety at its root.
Right.
So we feel anxious and fearful, and so we lash out in anger at someone else. So if you can still be listening for the anxiety or the fear, you know, and just ask them again, you know, so it sounds like you're really worried about what? Say more about that.
Well,
you can actually have a productive conversation about it.
Well, in all fairness, though, you know, you said your husband liked McCain for a long time, and you had said when we spoke with you earlier that he wanted, really wanted Sarah Palin for vice president. You, I appreciated your candor when you said that you really had the strong desire to smack him upside his head and knock some sense into him. So I want to know if you did it, and if so, how well did that work for you?
Yeah, somehow that doesn't work very well, mostly because his arms are longer than mine. and the impulse goes in both directions.
Yeah.
You know, so he's an interesting case because he both was a longtime McCain supporter, many years, and delighted when he actually got the nomination. And then my husband was arguing for many months that Sarah Palin should be the pick, so that when everybody else was surprised, who is this woman, I knew exactly who she was because he liked her so much. And he basically felt that the media, and I think even more than that, bloggers and commentators online treated her very badly. And so I can agree with that. I can agree and say, you know, I think people were harsh, and people have strong reactions to her. That I can definitely empathize with.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Liv on the line. Liv?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Dan. Hi, everybody. My story is, I think, a little different. My mother lives in Europe, and the day after the election, she sent an email to all of her children saying, you know, congratulations for electing Obama. You know, people in Europe are generally very happy that Bush won't be president and that we did elect somebody who's willing to talk to everybody. One sister-in-law responded with an email saying, we're moving to Alaska. And I responded back saying, well, don't forget to bring books because they burn them for heat up there, which I thought was funny. And another sister-in-law then sent me an email saying that wasn't funny, that was harsh. So here we are.
You know, I'm so glad that you said that because one of the hallmarks of this election, I thought, was the use of humor. Saturday Night Live, all sorts of online little videos and things like that, dance-offs and the like, and one of the things that developed is that if you're sending something to someone with your same view on whatever mm-hmm. side you're on, they're hysterical. You know, we think they're hilarious. But if one comes to me from the other side, I think it's mean-spirited or petty or nasty. And so humor actually ran along the divide as well and didn't cross over very well, even when it was well-intended.
So, mm-hmm. so what, I mean, that's the, you know, the comedy and tragedy thing. You know, you slip on a banana, it's funny, and I slip on a banana, it's tragic. But now, what's Liv to do about her,
yeah, and
her
also,
family?
I just want to add that, you know, when Bush was elected in 2004, it wasn't funny, and I didn't go around to my family and friends and say, well, he's this, that, or the other thing. I thought, he's my president, and I will try and honor him. And now it's so divided, you know, and I don't understand why. I don't understand why the one sister-in-law had to give me the little email lecture.
Well, I would wonder, and I'm going to ask this question to Sheila, what is Liv's responsibility in healing this, or does she have a responsibility? Is it just a question of their overreactivity?
I think we're all overreactive right now, you know? Like, the sister-in-law who's moving to Alaska or threatening to move to Alaska, had the election gone the other way, I personally would be threatening to move to Canada. So I can understand her impulse. You know, whether or not she actually was upset, I don't know. I don't know whether there was a conversation between she and your other sister-in-law. Mm-hmm. So that's one conversation that might happen. And a second conversation maybe to have is with the second sister-in-law who gave you the lecture. Mm-hmm. And she'll tell you, by the way, that you're overreacting to her giving you a lecture, which was not probably how she intended it. She probably intended it to help. empathizing with the impact it may have unintentionally had on the first sister-in-law. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of a triangulation of conversations to have, and I guess I would frame it less in terms of responsibility, although I actually agree with that frame on it, and more in terms of what does it mean for you, Liv, in that set of relationships? And will it continue to bother you if you don't talk about it?
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I couldn't agree more that that's what we have to do. We've got to shift the conversation, and we've got to open the dialogue. Liv, thanks so much for your call. Drew, let me just ask you, you know, we heard from Liv, we're hearing from a lot of people. The fire is pretty hot here. The passions are pretty high. What do we know about the brain that could help us diminish the intensity, or will it just happen?
It's a great question, and in some ways, what we have seen in this last election, the last couple of elections, we've seen that really the dangers of the Lee Atwater, Karl Rove style of politics that, you know, there were pundits saying up through, you know, 6 months ago that really the American people aren't that divided. It's just the elites who are divided. You know, it's just the pundits on television who are divided. And these kind of stories, I had a very similar one in my family with a cousin's husband who took offense to something I wrote in an email that I thought was humorous, and most people interpreted it as humorous on the email, but he didn't. And what all these kind of stories suggest is that the level of distrust and rancor that really started with the kind of politics of personal destruction that Atwater, who was the mastermind of the Willie Horton ad in 1988 against Michael Dukakis, that, you know, played on people's worst fears of dark-skinned black males, and the Karl Rove strategies of let's gay bait and win an election that way, that those kind of strategies have actually had a real impact on the culture, so that we can't have the kind of civil conversations about politics that we had in the past. And it's a reason why Barack Obama may have been a very good choice for this election, regardless of whether you were Democrat or Republican, in that, his whole theme was a theme of let's get away from that kind of politics and let's return to civility. I think it's pretty clear he's going to have a bipartisan cabinet. There's going to be at least one Republican in his cabinet. But to come back to the brain, we did a neuroimaging study or a brain scanning study back in the 2004 election, the heat of it between Kerry and Bush, where we presented partisans with threatening information about their own candidate and the other candidate. And basically what we found is that when given a reasoning task, you know, here's what John Kerry said in 1996 on Meet the Press about Social Security. Here's what he said in 2004. They're completely contradictory. We're scanning their brains as we ask, you know, do you see a contradiction here? And same thing for George W. Bush. And what we found is that Republicans could clearly see Kerry's contradictions. Democrats could clearly see Bush's contradictions. As a partisan, I might have wanted to locate the Fox News circuits of the brain that, you know, distort. But it turned out the Democrats and Republicans distorted equally, and that they could not see their own party's contribution. They couldn't see their own party standard bearers' contradictions.
Well, and that makes all the sense in the world, because Democrats and Republicans essentially have the same brain and work pretty much
exactly.
The same.
Design flaw in the brain, which is that when we really want to believe something, when new data come in, what we mostly do, if we're a strong adherent of that belief, and, you know, this is the basis of, you know, the reason why psychotherapy often takes so long, and I've been a clinician for 25 years, is because you're having to change deeply ingrained patterns that people are holding on to for a reason. And when someone's holding on to a partisan preference or partisan feelings for reasons, it's much easier to change the facts that come in than it is to change those partisan feelings.
And it sure does. And clutching onto those feelings really does give us the illusion of security. Well, we've got to take a break, and in that process, we're going to be saying goodbye to both of you and chatting with Phil Goldsmith. Sheila Heen, thank you for joining us again. Sheila teaches negotiation at Harvard Law School, and she's the co-author of Difficult Conversations. Drew Weston is a professor of psychology at Emory. He's written The Political Brain. Right after we take our break, we're going to be joined by Philip Goldsmith. He's held senior positions in government, most recently managing director in the city of Philadelphia. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Bloomsbury Auctions supports WHYY and will hold an auction Wednesday, November 19th in New York of the J.T. Snyder Collection, featuring the history of Philadelphia and important Americana. Details at 212-719-1000.
Next time on Day to Day.
Christine has a confession.
I kind of overdrew my checking account.
Nat has a secret, too.
We don't have a subprime mortgage, Nat.
Christine, no one here is dying.
Will Nat come clean?
What did you do to us?
And what about poor Anna Lee?
Can we please talk about this later? I have to go and I need a check.
Answers to these questions and more when we visit 11 Central Ave.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
A proud supporter of WHYY, BNY Mellon Wealth Management is dedicated to helping financially successful individuals and families protect and grow their wealth. Details at BNYMellonWealthManagement.com.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about psychological life in the aftermath of the election. I'm joined here by Phil Goldsmith, and he's held senior management positions in government. Most recently, was managing director of the city of Philadelphia. And Phil, I want to explore kind of the interior of what it's like for Barack Obama and all those around me. I should start with I don't know if you call it a disclaimer. Phil and I are friends and have been friends for several years. Phil, you recall the night we first met? We first met over dinner, and it was the night before Phil officially became city managing director under Mayor Street. Our whole dinner conversation was about what that was like for you. You were entering a world that you were clueless about.
Well, first of all, I appreciate the disclaimer. I consider it more of a badge of honor to be your friend,
well,
so
vice versa,
as opposed to a disclaimer. What I found, and I prior to the managing director's job, and look, I'm not going to equate being managing director being president of the United States. So let's get that off the table. But I was also head of the school district of Philadelphia prior to that, and they were both very difficult jobs, and I think in both cases I didn't have a clue of what I was getting into, even though I've been around. I was deputy mayor under Bill Green back in the early 80s. My office was two offices away from him, so I understood about city government. And I think basically what you realize is that you may know something intellectually, but there's a difference between knowing something intellectually and then feeling it in your gut. So I have no doubt that President-elect Obama has read a lot about transitions, has read a lot about presidencies, but I still think there's going to be a difference between his intellectually understanding it and then getting into the Oval Office when the doors close behind everyone.
I am trying to imagine, and I've used this phrase, I think, in a couple of times on the air. I'm trying to imagine what it's like going from, I mean, Joe Biden, when he introduced Joe Biden as his running mate, in his speech, Joe referred to him as Barack. And now, I mean, if West Wing is correct, and have to assume it always was, even his closest friends are calling him Mr. President-elect. I can't imagine how what life is like when your moniker changes like that.
Well, I think probably it started to really change for him when he was given Secret Service protection. And I forget exactly when that was, but it was, several months ago. And I think it probably dawned on him that his life was going to be different, that everywhere he went, he saw people with earphones or, wires in their ear and certain lapel pins and so forth protecting him. And so I think he's probably, been going through a transition. And I think as he got, closer to election day and they sort of realized that they were going to win this, that his, mentally things started to change. But it's going to be different when people speak to him differently and they're going to treat him differently. I was just reading a book about the Supreme Court, and there's a story in there where Chief Justice Rehnquist played in a card game every week, and he had played in that while he was a justice. And everyone called him Bill, the players, and there were lawyers and some other judges at the card table. And as soon as he became the Chief Justice, everyone started to call him Chief. Now, I don't know if that changed his hand at all, but clearly he started to sense a more of an arm's length relationship with his friends.
Yeah, and I would imagine that everyone would feel pretty much the same when your closest friends put you in an arm's length relationship.
Yes.
Which raises the question that between security around Obama or whoever and people calling him by a different name, this is really the beginning of what's euphemistically called the bubble, the barrier between the president and the people. I wonder what that's like on the inside, living in that bubble and initially and then later on. I mean, it feels uncomfortable initially, and then I worry that it gets comfortable over time.
Well, I think it probably does get comfortable, and your whole life is really being taken care of in terms of your family needs and, personal needs. You have people doing things that up till now you've had to do somewhat yourself. But I think the bubble happens because people are controlling your schedule and who gets to see you and when they get to see you and how they get to see you. Changes dramatically, and I think it requires an extraordinary person who's able to find out what else is going on out there and to get other people's viewpoints. And I think the hotter it gets, I think the tendency is to shield yourself more, and I think we've seen that with various presidents, it's certainly during our time.
To a greater or lesser degree.
Yes.
So what can he do, what should he do to keep himself more in touch with the regular people and himself, his own humanity here?
Well, I think the Internet's changed a lot. I mean, I think it was President Kennedy that stopped subscribing to, I think it was the Herald Tribune, because they were writing things about him that he didn't like, so he just cut it out, thinking that would solve those problems. But I think the access to the Internet and access to blogs and websites and so forth will bring the world to him. And my sense of him, I've never met him, I just know what I read and what I see, I think he has an intellectual curiosity about him. So I think he will be someone that will be reaching out by the Internet, and he certainly used the Internet to like no one's ever used it before in winning his presidency, to find out what is going on out there.
Yeah, he sure has used the Internet. We're talking with Phil Goldsmith. He's held senior positions in government. He was managing director under Mayor Street. We're talking about what life must be like on the inside during a transition. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Phil, I want to talk a little bit about why security is there in the first place. And it is about hatred. And I wonder how he deals with the hatred that's out there. Already a lot of people have been arrested who want to assassinate him. There's a lot of whispering out there, worrying about whether he will survive his presidency. So how does he deal knowing that there are people who want to kill him? Do you live in denial? I guess you have to, but there's a price you pay for that. Mayor Street, there was a lot of people who hated him also.
Well, I think that, I think he'll have the best security. And I think the best way for him to deal with that, and it's easier said than done, is for him not to worry about it and to realize that's one of the things that's been delegated to the Secret Service and people around him. If he's constantly looking over his shoulder, he's not going to succeed. But he will have people around him that will be looking over their shoulders and looking over his shoulders. And I think he's just going to have to deal with it. And I think, some presidents, I think it was President Kennedy and certainly Senator Kennedy, were very fatalistic. It was like, what's going to happen is going to happen. And so I think he's just got to rely on all the resources that the federal government has around him. I'm concerned about it because there is a lot of hatred out there. I mean, I've seen the literature that, for example, the NRA put out against him, and it just demonized him. And you just hope that people, don't react or act out of things like that. But I think we all have to go on and obviously hope for the best and rely on the Secret Service.
Well, and, we can hope that, what Drew Weston postulated early in the show is true, that the intensity will diminish over time, that it'll get worse first and then it'll get better.
He has a way about him also. I mean, I just saw it during the campaign, and I would say I did not start out as an Obama, supporter. I was somewhat neutral to him, but I think what brought me on was his calm in how he went through this campaign. And I think if people are calm, you act calm. If people act excited, you get excited. And so I think that will accrue to his benefit.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Kim on the line. Kim, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi, Dan. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. I think Phil touched on the extraordinary quality of Barack Obama, and his transition will be made easier because he is the most unusual human being as I hear about him. His staff, which was on 60 Minutes last night, said that he really he knows where he stands, and he knows who he is. And therefore, I think this transition will be made all the easier because this is an extraordinary man.
Phil, your thoughts? Thank you, Kim.
Well, I think he's obviously very bright in what he's accomplished is extraordinary. And I saw the same program, and I was impressed with his staff. I've been around a long time, so I don't always believe everything I read or hear, though I certainly want to believe that he knows where True North is, and he's able to follow that. I think he's got unbelievable challenges. And the thing about whenever you become president or even mayor for that matter, the challenges that you think you have when you're campaigning do not necessarily turn out to be the challenges that you face. We see that in Philadelphia. I don't think Mayor Nutter, while he may have seen storm clouds coming, never anticipated the extent of the financial situation and the impact it would have on his administration. And his administration will now pretty much be guided by the financial cuts and dealing with a budget, and his job is going to become much more as an accountant than it was what he had hoped when he ran. And we could say the same thing with President Bush. Mm-hmm. 9/11 happens, and all of a sudden. So I think all the transition plans and all the planning and all that stuff are great, but presidents make their greatness by how they handle the unpredictability. There's a great book out now called Black Swans by Nabeeb Talib, I think his name is, and his whole concept is how black swans are the unpredictable things that happen in life, and no one takes into account the unpredictable things that happen in life, and that's one of the reasons we got a financial mess on our hands now. So I really think his success will be how flexible and how nimble he is when the unanticipated happens. And I think one thing is predictable, that the unpredictable will happen.
Part of the job of a chief of staff or managing director is handling conflict. And from what we're told, the Bush White House had very little conflict. It wasn't tolerated. The Clinton White House seemed to have thrived on conflict. What's your thoughts about conflict management in the job?
I think President-elect Obama is going to be much more process-oriented. I just heard a little story that when he came to Philadelphia for, I guess, a debate with Senator Clinton, and then when he came here to give his speech on race, I was told that there was a lot of process that had to be gone through before those debate arrangements were made and so forth, where when the Republicans were here, they had it all sort of nailed down and everyone knew what they were supposed to do. And my guess is he's going to be much more process-oriented, and that will help, I think, not alleviate the conflicts, but put them in a framework that they can hopefully be resolved.
And his new chief of staff?
His new chief of staff, I think, is interesting. He's, you know, rough and tumble. He comes out of the, you know, Chicago political world. He's got sharp elbows. And I think it's an interesting pick that it seems to me that Obama's really saying, I know who I am, and I know I need someone to compliment me in this office, as opposed to someone that just mirrors him. So I think that's our first sort of indication of his management style and the type of people that he's going to surround himself with.
Yeah, it also says something about his priorities that he picked chief of staff first.
Yes.
Many experts recommend that's the first job you have to take.
Yes.
Phil, thanks so much for
my pleasure.
For joining us. It was really interesting. So Phil Goldsmith has held many city offices. He was recently managing director of the city of Philadelphia under Mayor Street. Earlier on, we heard from Sheila Heen, who teaches negotiation at Harvard Law School and has written Difficult Conversations. We also heard from Drew Western, who's a professor of psychology at Emory and has written The Political Brain. Next week, we'll be talking about cyberbullying and its impact on teens. Well, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org or reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Voices in the Family is co-produced by Gita Simons and Alisa Walters. And Elizabeth Peris Luna is the executive producer in charge of content. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, the host. Enjoy your week, my friends.